All right, hello, and welcome back to Real Seekers. I'm your host, Dale, the Real Seeker. And today I have a special treat. I brought on a friend and fellow podcaster, Kevin Non-Tradycath. Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Pretty good, Dale. How about you? Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Yeah, I'm great. I've been looking forward to it. We've been kind of internet friends for a while now, but we've never been on each other's podcasts until I kind of said, like, why aren't we doing shows together, you know? Yeah, so I was on your show talking about the Shroud of Turin, speaking about a few of those historical dating evidences and that sort of thing. And on your end, I wanted to bring you on for your expertise because you are, as it says in your name, I assume that's not your last name, Non-Tradycath.
No, it is not my real last name, no.
Okay, so yeah, actually, I should shut up. Before we even get into today's topic, why don't you take some time to introduce the audience as to who you are, maybe a little bit about your background, and share some of your faith journey, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good idea, because I know that your audience is going to be, I imagine that your audience is going to be more broad than my audience, probably. So, hi, everyone. My name's Kevin, and I grew up traditionalist Catholic. So that's a type of Christianity that is fairly uncommon. What it means to be a traditionalist Catholic is that you attend the Mass in Latin the way that it was said prior to the Second Vatican Council in 1962. So before 1962, all Masses everywhere were said in Latin. After the Second Vatican Council, Masses were then changed just to be in whatever local language was spoken in that country. But a group of Catholics kind of splintered off because they didn't like saying Mass in English and Spanish and Mandarin and French and Italian. They wanted to keep Mass in Latin, so they kind of splintered off. And for a hot minute, they were actually kind of like, well, excommunicated. So were they really Catholic at that point? That's not up to me to decide. But then there was further splintering. Some groups got back in line with Rome. Other groups reconciled with Rome. Other groups split off and didn't want to reconcile at all. So traditionalist Catholic is kind of like a really broad category. And without getting super into the details, I grew up in the FSSP. That is a Latin acronym. And the English translation of the acronym would stand for the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter. That is a traditionalist organization that is fully in communion with Rome. So it would be really hard for anybody to say that the FSSP isn't really Catholic. So I grew up really Catholic in the sense that we were in communion with Rome. And we took our faith very seriously. I went to Mass 6 days a week for the most part. I went to confession once a week. I received my first Holy Communion and was enrolled into the scapular. That's something that we're going to talk about in a little bit. When I was seven, I guess. I was confirmed when I was like 12. And so my confirmation name is St. John Vianney because I thought he's the patron saint of priests. I thought I wanted to be a priest when I was 12 or whatever. Clearly that didn't work out for me. I wound up meeting a girl and fell in love. And so we got married when we were 22. The way that we got married is a whole story in and of itself, but I'll save that for another time, I guess. I wound up when I was 22 telling my family, I don't really believe in all of this Catholicism stuff anymore. And then I wound up moving 700 miles away, and it's been kind of crazy since then. That's kind of me in a nutshell. I grew up traditionalist Catholic, and kind of my entire faith journey to this point has been like, I really don't think that I have enough reason to be Catholic. I don't think that the arguments for Catholicism are sufficient. And so for that reason today, I call myself an agnostic. So I don't think about myself as an atheist. I don't. I also don't call myself a theist either. I see really compelling arguments on the side of theism. I also see fairly compelling reasons on the side of atheism too. So I call myself an agnostic. And the one thing that I know, right? The one thing that I'm kind of certain about is that I don't have enough reason to be Catholic. And that's what I'm primarily here for today is like, hey, look, I don't think that the following reasons are good reasons to be Catholic. And these are going to be some reasons that you'll hear some online Catholics talking about. So hopefully I can kind of help, add the other perspective than the Catholic perspective to that side of the conversation.
Gotcha. So just a couple quick questions on that. So one, in terms of these tradie Catholics or traditional Catholics, Mel Gibson's one of those, correct? Like, I remember hearing somewhere. Okay.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. So he's in that group. Do you know if he's in excommunication or is he in a communication group? Just curious.
So I believe that his family was part of the SSPX. The SSPX is a weird group, and the FSSP is actually a splinter group from the SSPX. So without getting like crazy into details, the FSSP split off from the SSPX because the FSSP wanted to get back in line with Rome, and the SSPX did not. That occurred in the 1980s, I believe. So before I was born. For the record, I was born in 1995. So I was born into the FSSP post-split with the SSPX. But the SSPX today is no longer not in communion with Rome, but they're also kind of not in communion with Rome either. The term that Rome uses to describe their relationship with the SSPX is that they are in it's like not ordinary communion. They say like we're in like a unique communion with them, or like we're in a non-standard communion. I forget what the exact language is to describe Rome's connection to the SSPX. But what I will say, and this kind of matters, is that the SSPX isn't really like under the bishop. So like there's the way that the Catholic Church is structured, there's a bishop over each geography. And FSSP priests if their bishop said to them, like, you have to stop, knock it off or something, the FSSP would say, yes, bishop, we will get in line. The SSPX doesn't answer to their local bishops by and large. So they are like outside of the official ecclesiastical structure of the church, but they are still in some form of like non-standard communion with Rome. And I think that there have been talks going on for decades between the SSPX and Rome to see if they can kind of like reconcile. And it hasn't happened in any kind of official format yet, but clearly progress has been made because previously they were excommunicated and today they are no longer excommunicated and they are in some form of communion, even if it's not like ordinary communion with Rome. So yeah. And Mel Gibson is SSPX. So, you know, is he Catholic? Do you think that the SSPX is Catholic? This seems to be kind of like an unresolved question, or at least if it is resolved, it's just not at all clear what the answer is. So it's confusing.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, apart from you, I had never even heard of these groups within groups and all this stuff in the Catholic Church. So it's interesting, right, to learn about that stuff. Suddenly those 35,000 Protestant denominations don't look like such a big deal.
And it's funny too, because even within the official bounds of the Catholic Church, you have like organizations like there's the Melkite Catholics. The Melkite Catholics are a non-Roman Catholicism. So like most Catholics are Roman Catholics, but the Melkites are not Roman Catholic. They are like Melkite Catholic. And so like they kind of just don't give a hoot what the Pope says. But they're still Catholic somehow. Like it's interesting. It's like you're Catholic and you just kind of like don't really, you're like, well, yeah, but I'm not Roman. And you're like,
that makes the difference. So they like all the doctrines, but just take the doctrines, leave the Pope out of it, I guess. So.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't tell you that they leave the Pope out of it altogether. It's just kind of like, it's weird. They don't leave the Pope out of it. Officially, they are under the Pope. Officially. It's just kind of like it's like an informal, like they're only under the Pope in like an informal kind of way. Yeah, like there are various Catholic denominations that are still Catholic, but they're different. And then like you said, like the critique about the one Catholic Church and like look at all those Protestant denominations, the more that you learn about Catholicism, I think the less teeth that argument has, in my opinion.
Same deal with Eastern Orthodoxy as well. When I look at, there's divisions within divisions and all that stuff there too. Mm-hmm. My last follow-up question before we get into today's topics. So I noticed very quickly, you've been very emphatic that, look, you discovered that Roman Catholicism is false. The evidence supporting it is insufficient. But then you kind of jumped from, okay, well, since Catholicism's false, I'm an agnostic now. Like, why didn't you consider Protestantism or Orthodoxy or even other religions and stuff? Why the jump to agnosticism?
Yeah, so I kind of did consider Protestantism for like a very brief period, I would say. Like in college, I was attending CRU. Like, do you guys have CRU up in Canada? Campus Crusade for Christ?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I was attending CRU meetings and stuff like that in college, and I was definitely the only... I was still telling people I was Catholic at that time, but I was very clearly like, I had my problems with the Catholic Church, and I was like, well, let me just attend CRU and see what CRU's all about. So I was the only Catholic in the room when I was at those CRU meetings. And so there may have been like a brief period where I did consider myself maybe like, I probably wouldn't have even said I was Protestant per se. More, I might have said that I was merely Christian, like all off C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity or something like that. But that wasn't long lived. And I think that my jump to agnosticism was kind of like the, like, okay, like this organization that I was part of claimed to be the, like, we spent half of our time just bashing Protestantism. So it didn't really seem like a valid option to me, if you know what I'm saying. Like, I was kind of taught my whole life that like, this is the one true authentic form of Christianity. It's not just Catholicism, but like traditional Catholicism. And so when all of a sudden the one valid form, the one authentic form of Christianity, I would say, oh, wait, this doesn't work. I was kind of left with nothing. I think that I may have wound up as some kind of non-Catholic Christian if my upbringing hadn't been so radically like, selective, or so radically like, hey, look, they're all wrong. We're the only correct one. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like if I didn't have that attitude, I may have turned Christian, non-Catholic.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. And obviously, that's why God brought me into your life with the shroud. I will get you back into Protestantism someday.
So, I like it. I like it.
All right, cool. So with that said, we are limited on time just because, today is the total eclipse. And I know Kevin, he wants to be there to see that. I'm in Ontario, so I know my brother's down in Niagara Falls, which is apparently the best place to see it and all that stuff. But so with that said, I want to get straight into today's topics. And we have two topics. So the first is Kevin has an amazing series, which I go check out his videos, because I'm totally ignorant about this, but he goes into the various Eucharistic miracles and Roman Catholic miracles and explains, he even rates them. And then the second topic is going to be this doctrine of apostolic succession. So with that said, Kevin, I want to turn it over to you. I know you've got your slides there. So go ahead. And I see we have some audience. If you guys have questions, Kevin wants me to bring that up as he presents. So feel free if you have a question when he's saying something, and I will bring it up to him on the spot. But yeah, take it away, Kevin.
Awesome. Thanks, Dale. And then just to reiterate, don't hold your questions to the end. I don't want this to be a presentation as much as I want it to be a conversation, which is guided by a couple slides that I put together. Don't feel like you have to hold your questions. Please interrupt me. I would love it if you interrupted me. And then one other note that I would like to make before we get started is, the first category is kind of like Catholic miracles that I don't think are good reasons for you to become Catholic. And I kind of structured this into like, you know, 1A, 1B, and then 2, where 2 is apostolic succession. But 1A is going to be Eucharistic miracles, and 1B is going to be Marian apparitions. So we're going to cover a few of each. This will not be exhaustive of every Eucharistic miracle that has ever occurred. It will not be exhaustive of every Marian apparition that you've ever heard of, but I did select a few. And the reason I'm actually able to cover, so I picked 4 Eucharistic miracles and 3 Marian apparitions, that's 7 of them. And I plan to cover them relatively quickly. And you might be thinking about the Shroud of Turin and thinking like, oh my gosh, like you could not cover the Shroud of Turin properly in an hour and a half. How are we going to fit 7 different miracles into an hour and a half? Well, not to spoil anything, but you will be shocked and disappointed at the quality of the science that has gone into Eucharistic miracles and Marian apparitions if you are expecting the quality of science that has gone into the Shroud of Turin.
Out of curiosity, just before you begin, just to give the audience kind of a sense, first place, how many, I guess we're starting with Eucharistic miracle, but just how many are Eucharistic miracles where science has been involved? Are there? And of the 3 or 4 that you're selecting, do you consider those to be the best among them?
So I selected four Eucharistic miracles that I think are the best studied. However, the question of how many Eucharistic miracles are there is almost impossible to answer, because there will be a story about a Eucharistic miracle that occurred at somebody's home parish where the host started bleeding, but then after 10 seconds, it was no longer bleeding. And like multiple people saw it or something like that. And then that's it. And it's kind of just like an urban legend at that point. So do you count that as a miracle? Like, it was never submitted for any kind of testing. It was never like, it was only seen by like, you know, a handful of people, but you know, the kind of the urban legends will kind of grow. So do you count that as a miracle? So for that reason, like, it's really difficult to say how many Eucharistic miracles there have been. But if you pay attention to Catholic media, you hear about a Eucharistic miracle, you know, one that occurs that's big enough to make the news, I would say maybe once a year, once every other year. Like, they're fairly common.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Yes. And the ones you selected, you think they are probably among the best, the better ones that you've seen evidentially.
Yes. And you, exactly. You'll be shocked at how poorly evidenced they are. If you're expecting Shroud of Turin level analysis, you're going to have a bad time.
Fair enough. All right. Yeah. Over to you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did kind of spoil the first slide a little bit. It's just the agenda for today. So these are the four Eucharistic miracles that we're going to discuss. Then we're going to do Marian apparitions. Then we're going to talk apostolic succession. So that's kind of like 1A, 1B, and 2. Okay. Before we jump into any of the four specific Eucharistic miracles that we're going to talk about today, I would like to talk about themes to consider. So I want you to consider whether or not any of these miracles had their results published in peer-reviewed journals. About those results, were they ever made public? And then the third bullet point there is cults of personality. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is science, when done well, does not matter who the scientist is. The science matters. The scientist does not matter. I want you to pay attention to whether or not that appears to be the case in the case of, for these four Eucharistic miracles. And right alongside that point, I also want everyone to pay attention to whether or not they think that the scientists that are performing these tests were hand-selected by the Vatican or not. Okay. Those are the four things that I want us to pay attention to as I go over these next couple of slides. And then also this little cartoon image on the right, that's called a monstrance. So that white circle in the middle is the Eucharist, the little piece of unleavened bread that Catholics hold up during the consecration. And that little piece of bread stops being bread. And then by the end of the consecration, that little piece of bread isn't bread anymore. Now it's the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. And it's not a symbol. It really is his body, blood, soul, and divinity. Okay, so after the host is consecrated, you're not just going to like leave it around, right? You're going to like leave it in the monstrance. And the monstrance is that gold display case, for lack of a better term. Okay, so that's what I want us to look out for. And the reason why I wanted to explain what the monstrance is because all four of these Eucharistic miracles, I have photographs of them as displayed in a monstrance. So if you look on the image on the right, there is a circle inside of the monstrance. Now it's not white because, well, it's really old. But that is what we are going to be talking about. That circular thing with a big hole in the middle inside the display case of the monstrance. That is what we are going to be talking about for the Eucharistic miracle at Lanciano.
Now, can I just interject here? Mm-hmm. Again, you asked for this, so I'm not trying to be rude or anything.
No, I love it.
Now, something you said, because there's actually a debate going on ESG, but you said that it's no longer white, like it's no longer new because it's really old. Now, some Roman Catholics have been having a debate about the shroud that I can't give details about, but they were raising this general thing that, well, according to Roman Catholics, actually, no, this was on S.J. Thomason's thing. You were in the live chat there, but they were debating, look, can't Jesus' blood and body would never degrade over time. It's he's divine, stuff like that. So isn't that, wouldn't that, if this thing's degrading over time, wouldn't that prove to a Roman Catholic that it's not Jesus' body? Or, yeah, how would they explain that away?
For the best kind of answer, I would like, I would really want to hand that over to somebody like SJ or just any other kind of Catholic apologist and let them answer it. I'll put on my Catholic hat for a second, though, and I'll try to say something that might resemble an answer that a Catholic apologist would give. Hey, even though Jesus was fully God, he was also fully man. And flesh that comes from somebody who is fully man will decay. And so Jesus's body ascended into heaven 40 days after Easter. But the parts that didn't are still 100% man and so will decay. Okay, that was my best shot. I don't know if I buy that myself, but...
Gotcha. Yeah, I was just curious, like, what the official doctrine says. Like, does it say it can't decay, or does it allow in this way for it to decay, like any other blood and stuff like that?
We're actually going to get into a little bit of that right here. Okay. Because, so, yeah, let me jump into the miracle of Lanciano, because there's a statement in the miracle of Lanciano that I would like to kind of share a little bit. So, okay, let me give you a brief background of the miracle of Lanciano as you would hear it from a pulpit if you were like at a Catholic mass and the sermon of that day just so happened to be about the miracle at Lanciano. Okay, in the 700s or so, in the 8th century, there was a priest, a monk, who was saying mass. And during the consecration, he was holding up the host, and I'm going to turn to face the camera a little bit. He was holding up the host like this, and he realized as he was staring at the host that he didn't really believe that he was turning the piece of bread that he was holding into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ just by saying those words during the consecration. And he prayed in his mind, God, if I really am turning this piece of bread into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, give me a sign. And at that exact moment, the piece of bread, now the piece of bread always turns into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ substantially at every single Catholic mass, but substances and accidents aren't the same thing. So the substance is what a thing really is, but the accidents are what the thing looks like, kind of. So at a normal Catholic mass, only the substance changes. The accidents do not change. So it still looks like bread. If you put it under a microscope, it would still look like bread. But in this case, because he asked for a sign, God turned that Eucharist into the body, blood, soul, and divinity, not just substantially, but also accidentally. So essentially, the piece of bread literally turned into flesh, human flesh. And so this priest was obviously probably a little freaked out, but also realized that this was a miracle. And so he kind of kept the piece of Jesus's flesh as a holy relic. And this holy relic was passed down through the ages from the 8th century up until modern day. By the way, in the 1970s, one scientist, his name is Dr. Linoli. Dr. Linoli was able to get his hands on a tiny piece of the flesh, and he published, this is exactly how you will hear it, Dr. Linoli published a scientific journal article outlining his findings, and he declared that this is indeed a human heart tissue. And because it's human heart tissue, you know, now we know that this really is a miracle, because this used to be the Eucharist and now it's a piece of human heart tissue. That's fantastic. Yay. Okay. That's what you're going to hear from a Catholic priest during Sunday Mass. But that's not the whole picture. The historicity of this whole thing is very shaky. It is purported to have occurred in the 8th century. However, the first known references to the miracle come from the 16th century. So the first known references that we have to it are some monks writing about it in the 1500s. Prior to the 1500s, nobody wrote anything about the miracle of Lanciano.
Yeah.
That's a long time. That's 900 years or something, like 800 years.
I don't see the historians lining up to embrace this as a reliable tradition or something like that. So.
Absolutely not. So that's a bad sign, right? Just from the historicity standpoint. Now, I suppose that a Catholic could say, hey, look, this miracle actually probably occurred in the 15th century or something, but over the course of 100 years, the legends about it grew, and like it got older and older over the course of, 100 years or whatever. And then by the time the 16th century rolled around, the story had been exaggerated that it happened 800 years ago instead of 100 years ago. But hey, look, it's still a Eucharistic miracle, right? And maybe they would say that because, hey, look, it was analyzed by Dr. Linoli in the 1970s and it was published. Well, was it published? We can actually take a look at the scientific journal article. And you know what I might do, Dale, if it's all right, is I'll share my screen. Because I don't think I'll be able to click on that link through this.
So I'll take down the slides then.
Perfect. It might be helpful for me just to share a couple things real quick. I'm not going to share things on every single slide, but this, it makes sense for me to share. So
while you're bringing that up, I'm just going to say, Mr. Jetty, this was great. Yeah, Jesus is divine and we are the branches.
That's really good. Okay. I am going to go ahead and share my screen. It is going to be right here. Okay, Dale, I should be sharing it. If you're able to throw that up on the screen, perfect. This is linked in the slides. And by the way, I'm going to share the whole presentation with Dale so that Dale can post it to his website and then you'll have all these links. But this is the paper that Dr. Linoli, there's his name, Linoli, Dr. Linoli published. And you can see that this was published as part of the Anatomical Pathway Laboratory of the Annalisi Clinic. That's what it says up here. And then if I scroll down, you will see the report. Now, this is in Italian. However, and it's annoying because it's a scan, but I was actually able to translate the whole thing into English. I'm going to keep scrolling down before I show you my English translation of it. And obviously, I would tell you guys to get the Italian, the original Italian, and then compare it to my translation to make sure that I wasn't doing anything wrong. But okay, that's the end of the actual paper. It's 4 pages long. So ready? 1, 2, 3, 4. And then the rest of it is just pictures of what Dr. Linoli saw under the microscope. So I guess at this point, I'll just scroll to the end, I guess. The rest of it is just pictures. So that's what the actual report is. And I know that this makes no sense to you because it's in Italian. But what I'm going to do real quick is I'm going to pull up the English one. Give me 1 second. I'm less prepared than I should be. But I'm just going to go into my Google Drive real quick and grab this. Here it is. This is the English translation that I did through just Google Translate.
And feel free to send me the original paper and this, and I'll include them as attachments as well for people.
Perfect. That's what I'll do. So here you go. Look at the way that the paper starts. Ancient Christian tradition has handed down to us that at the beginning of the 7th century, a friar of the Basilian order, while officiating mass in the church of that church, doubtful of the truth inherent of the sacred rite, revealed with great dismay, together with the people present, the transformation of the host into the flesh and wine, of the host into flesh and of the wine into blood. So just uncritically, the very first sentence of the paper is just a blatant acceptance of this tradition that has absolutely no historical backing. Okay. Memory of this event has never been lost throughout the centuries. And so this is where the translation gets a little weird, but I think you can essentially ignore that part. It's just throughout the centuries, memory of this event has never been lost. I mean, that's not true. The first time that we hear about it is in the 15th or the 16th century. The miraculous flesh and blood always preserved in Lanciano was subjected to reconnaissance. I believe that means viewing in 1574, 1770, and 1886. What that means is this is actually kept hidden in a monastery, and it's not. The public has only seen it on a handful of occasions. However, the Basilica of Lanciano in 1970 reached out to Dr. Lanoli and asked him to look at it. And so he says that, so it's preserved in an 18th century monstrance. There's that monstrance again. He says that the tissue layer appears thin and widely torn in the central area due to the retraction of tissue towards the periphery, where it appears in raised circular folds. The surface is smooth, never unevenly raised, cracked or etched. He goes on just describing what he sees. And he says that the present study is directed towards ascertaining the histological structure of the tissue to determine whether the hardened stony substance passed down as blood responds to the characteristics of blood, to establish to which biological species the flesh and blood belong, to specify the group in two tissues, and to investigate the protein and mineral components of the blood. And so then he describes what he's doing, and then he just includes pictures. And I didn't include the pictures in my Google translation because they're just pictures. But pretty much all that he's saying is, yeah, I looked at it and I think that this is a human heart tissue and I think that it's really blood. And all I did was look at it under a microscope. Well,
that's under the methods of investigation. Is that all that he did? He just looked at it? Or did, because it looked like some of his pictures might have been from a microscope maybe. Or again, it was in black and white, so I couldn't.
He looked at it under a microscope. So I work in the pharmaceutical industry, and we do a lot of histology as part of studies. Sometimes we work on drugs that are supposed to help your liver. And so the way that we tell if the drug is working or not is we take a little slice of your liver and we look at it under a microscope. Now, there's a preparation of the liver sample. You don't just take a little piece of liver and just look at it under a microscope. You wash it with a certain substance that's going to highlight the defects that you're hoping to see. You're going to put it between two pieces of glass so that the sample isn't so fragile and stuff like that. And that's exactly what Dr. Lanoli does here. He prepares the sample for a histological examination. But at the end of the day, this is what he was doing. He was just taking these pictures. Like these pictures are the results of his study. And then he's saying, I think that these pictures resemble human heart tissue. Now, I'm not an expert in pathology, but I'm actually willing to grant that this is human heart tissue. Like, I have no idea if it is or isn't, but I'm willing to grant that it's human heart tissue. What happens if we do grant that this is human heart tissue? Well, all that's going to happen is that we have some human heart tissue that was claimed to be from the 8th century, despite no evidence of it existing prior to the 16th century. That's best case scenario. And that's it. That's the whole thing. And I'm serious. There's never been another study published on the Lanciano Eucharist. That's it. So if you were expecting something like the Shroud, where there's actually been tons and tons of papers published on it with actually sophisticated science, nothing like that. Nothing. This is the extent. And if you're not particularly impressed by a best case scenario of some human heart tissue being preserved in a monstrance claimed to be from the 8th century, but we have no evidence of it existing prior to the 16th century, then I have really bad news for you for the next ones, because this is the most science that we're going to talk about today.
Really? Okay. So that's interesting. So let's take it. So there's three main critiques that I see here. So the first is just obvious. It's a historical critique. Look, that zero evidence for 700 years or something for attesting this event is very bad evidence from a secular historical perspective. Now, granted, I would say that the lack of historical provenance in and of itself doesn't prove anything, right? For example, we lack evidence, a lot of evidence for the Shroud's history. But if you can establish there's a miracle scientifically, I think that's good enough and sufficient. But I just wanted to know, in terms of the history end, so our first records are from the 1500s. Has there been any evolving of the legend? Like, has the tale of the miracle changed over time, or has it actually remained consistent since the 16th century, at least in terms of what the claim is?
I believe that it's remained consistent since the 16th century. Although to be clear, like, just the amount of people actually studying the historicity of the miracle of Lanciano compared to people studying the historicity of the Shroud of Turin, for instance, it's night and day. So I'll tell you that I'm not aware of any changes to the, like, if you read, I have read the source from the 16th century, and it essentially says exactly what, well, actually, Dr. Lannone quotes it in his, he quotes from that 16th century source in his essay, when he says, like, you know, there was a monk who was doubting, and then it turned into the flesh of Jesus, and that's it. And that's pretty much the story today. So I don't think that the story has changed much since the 16th century.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So the next objection is, so look, the main problem here is, number one, we don't have peer review, and we just got one expert saying they studied it and they believe, based on their judgments, that this is a human heart tissue. Now, to your mind, obviously, I would be skeptical of that when it comes to Walter McCrone. He's claimed to find paint, just one guy versus everyone else studying the shroud saying the opposite. Now, in this case, I'm wondering about the counter. Have there been any experts who've looked at his pictures and come out and saying this is not human heart tissue? Is there any scientific reason to doubt that this is human heart tissue that you know of?
No, I don't know of anybody who's actually tried to follow up on Dr. Lanciano's work. And because it's not peer reviewed, I don't think anybody's actually published anything to the contrary. And that's why I'm actually willing to grant that it is human heart tissue.
Okay.
It very well might be human heart tissue. Like, that's fine.
Okay. So go ahead.
You'll see that I'm not so generous to the next ones.
Okay. Well, last question here, and I'll let you go. But okay, so let's grant that it is everything the Roman Catholic can want here. It is actual human heart tissue. How would you explain that? If not a miracle, what do you think is an equally probable or more probable explanation for, is it fraud? Like, did they put that on there? Or?
The Catholic Church has a long history of fraud. So I don't know if you know about this, but there were medieval churches that had Mary's breast milk.
Yep.
And that's not the weirdest one. You know how many of them? There were multiple foreskins of the child Jesus being passed around it's weird stuff, man. So I don't think it's crazy that at any point prior to the 16th century, some less than honest monk was looking to increase donations to his monastery so that he can live a more lavish lifestyle. As we know, occurred in medieval Europe, plenty of people were happy to abuse their religion in order to, you know, make a quick buck. I don't see why some unscrupulous monk couldn't have simply taken a piece of human heart tissue. Or even, my understanding is that it's very difficult to tell the difference between pig heart tissue and human heart tissue. I don't see why he couldn't have taken a piece of pig heart, carved it up into a circle, put it in a monstrance, and been like, hey, look, everybody, a Eucharistic miracle happened 800 years ago. Here it is. Why don't you come check out my church on a pilgrimage and donate money to my church?
Gotcha.
Now, obviously, I don't have evidence of this. However, we do know that these kinds of things happened in the 16th century European Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And just given the lack of evidence to this having existed prior to the 16th century, I just have a really hard time believing the story that stems from the 8th century.
Gotcha.
Do
you think it would be possible maybe there's a modern fraud involved in some way? Is that a possibility, or you would be less likely to consider that, I think?
I don't think that Dr. Lannone himself was involved in any kind of fraud. However, you will see that there seems to be a hand selection of scientists going on. Now, I don't have anything about that on this slide. However, in future slides, you will see that the scientists who are selected are not selected at random. They are not. They are selected because they've shown a willingness to work on other Catholic stuff. They are clearly devout Catholics themselves. Dr. Lannone is clearly a devout Catholic himself. He was not selected randomly because he was the best scientist to work on this sample. No. he was selected because he was probably already known to the team who runs the monastery at Lanciano. Now, I can't confirm that. And Dr. Linoli himself, at least in that paper, does not write about how he got the sample, other than the monastery reached out directly to him and said, we would like you to take a look at the sample.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And I don't think I mentioned this, but this journal was essentially published by Dr. Linoli himself. It was not peer-reviewed. It was not published in a real journal. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, thank you so much. I'll let you move on with the next miracle.
Okay, cool. The next miracle we're going to talk about, and I'm so sorry, the title got cut off, but it should read The Eucharistic Miracle at Buenos Aires. And I shouldn't actually say miracle, but rather miracles. In 1992, it actually occurred three times. Then it occurred again in 1994 and again in 1996. So this is kind of three or five separate miracles, because the three that occurred in 1992 all occurred within the same, like, relatively short time span, like a few months at the most. I don't recall offhand. But all of this was in Buenos Aires at the same church. Okay. I have a link at the top of this slide to a pamphlet. And for the rest of the Eucharistic miracles, a pamphlet is going to be the best thing that was published about these miracles. There won't be any actual articles, peer-reviewed or not peer-reviewed. There's simply no more articles. The best thing that we are going to have are pamphlets, the next two of which were both published by Professor Castañón Gómez. Professor Castañón Gómez worked for the Catholic Church, and he hand-selected scientists to look at the miracle at Buenos Aires. The two scientists that were selected to look at these Eucharistic miracles, one of them was Dr. Linoli. If that sounds familiar, just go back one slide, because that's the same guy who looked at this one. Why would you have the same scientist looking at it twice unless you were looking for somebody who was already apt to believe in these things, right? And the other scientist was Dr. Zugaba. Dr. Zugaba, first of all, when he published, all he did was publish a statement. And he's actually done interviews. You can actually watch interviews of Dr. Zugaba, like even just within the past couple of years, talking about this miracle. And you can tell that he's a devout Catholic. But he wrote that from the sample that he analyzed, he could tell that the sample came from a human heart, and not just any human heart, but a human heart that had been under severe stress, as if the owner had been beaten severely about the chest. I'm sorry. I work in pharma. That is not how any of this works. You don't look at a sample under, like, you know, like prepared on a slide as part of like an AP like examination. AP standing for anatomic pathway. Anatomic pathway or pathology. Sorry, anatomic pathology. You don't tell that somebody had been severely beaten about the chest. Dude, you're cutting the man open and taking, of course he's beaten severely. The cells of that sample are going to look like bad stuff, right?
One thing I just want to raise for the audience here, because this is potentially interesting on my end. Dr. Frederick T. Zugaby, where does he come from? The Shroud of Turin. This is a famous medical expert that pro Shroud guys, including myself, appeal to. So, I just wanted to point out that connection.
Is that an E? It might be.
I think it is.
I wrote some of this based off of memory. Let me like look at my. It doesn't matter. But yes, this guy is not like impartial. He was Catholic enough that he wrote a book in 1982 about the Shroud of Turin. Why are we hand selecting our scientists like this? Like, this is not real science.
Well, one thing I guess I should come back as a, I will admit this, in academia, there is remarkable, and I've experienced it firsthand, and I'm in freaking philosophy. I can imagine what it's like in science, because me and Teddy, we've tried to get secular scientists involved in doing experiments. And once you mention something that's religious, there is a remarkable closed-mindedness. People don't want to waste their time and do that. So I just wanted to kind of, out of fairness, that it may be they can only get these people who are willing to do it, something like that. But yeah, if you want to address that as well, while you're addressing it, Mr. Jetty asks, what kind of doctor is Dr. Lanoli and Dr. Zugabee, if it's Zugabee? I'm assuming it was. But
So Dr. Lanoli was a professor of biology, perhaps. And I think he specialized in anatomic pathology. So like he's like a relevant expert in the field. It's not like he was a it's not like he had his PhD in physics and he was looking at this stuff. Like I believe that Dr. Lanoli was like an expert in the field. So I'm not like denying that Dr. Lanoli was a like an expert. And for Dr. Zugabee, I actually don't recall what his expertise is. But I do actually call into question the expertise of some of the doctors. Let me look. I'm going to cheat and look ahead real quick to see if I...
The audience, so it is Frederick. I just looked it up. It is Frederick Zugabee. He's a forensic pathologist by trade.
Okay. So I don't think I included it in my slides, but I believe that there was one doctor who was put in charge of analyzing one Eucharistic miracle, probably not this one. But the doctor had like a PhD in like he was a lawyer. Like he was like a lawyer of medical law. And he actually wound up having to outsource somebody else to look at the like pathological reports of the sample. I don't recall what Eucharistic miracle that was, but it is a good idea. Like whenever you're looking at these cults of personality, I do think it is a good idea to actually like look, like if it's not a whole team of scientists in a peer-reviewed paper, I think it's fair game to actually question the validity of the person doing the testing. Like I don't think that's unfair. Something else that I'll add is the pamphlets are so weird. This is an actual sentence from the published pamphlet, which is linked right there. The lady doctor, however, was not able to perform the genetic examination since in those times it was not easy to do. Lady doctor? Like what? Again, this is a pamphlet. It's not like a real journal article or anything, but just lady doctor. Like that's such like a weird thing to say. And also I love how they're making excuses for them not performing genetic examinations on these samples. I have more on genetic examination of these samples on the next slide, but I just want to point that out because it's super weird. Like it's so weird. And also what I will say about the Eucharistic miracle of Buenos Aires too, just regarding the historicity, these events occurred in 1992, 94, and 96. They were analyzed in 2001. And I believe that they were analyzed they may have been analyzed first in like 98 or 99 or something. So the chain of custody is much better. It's not 900 years or whatever. It's like 3 and 4 years and stuff like that. So it is much better. But even then, it's not like we actually have chain of custody. Like we have priests in Buenos Aires delivering samples to hand-selected doctors. And we're just kind of like trusting that like the sample that they gave is the same sample. You know what I mean? Like there's no real chain of custody. Like it's just kind of like we're trusting that everyone's being honest here. So again, that's probably why you don't see this stuff being published in like actual peer-reviewed journal articles, because there's not enough like rigor that have gone into these things that we can actually like say anything definitively.
Gotcha. Cool. I'm just going to let you keep, just because we are running out. I know you got.
Oh yeah. Wow. I like to talk.
I'm going
to
let you do the full presentation on the Eucharistic miracles. If I have questions that time, I'll ask one or two and then I'll let you continue because I want to make sure you finish this.
So. Perfect. I've got two more slides and I'll make this one real quick. So the Eucharistic miracle at Tixla, Mexico occurred in 2006. And who was selected by the Vatican to look into it? Professor Castañón Gómez, again, which is, again, hand selection of scientists. I linked to the pamphlet again there at the hyperlink, but I took screenshots of the pamphlet because there's a blatant contradiction in the pamphlet that I would love to point out. So one part of the pamphlet says, when the work of sequencing to extract the genetic profile was done, they were never able to obtain it. Grammar aside, because I do believe that these are translations. Like I believe that Professor Castañón Gómez's first language is Spanish, so these might just kind of be like awkward translations. But what they were saying on that left one is, hey, look, we tried to do genetic profiling, but we weren't able to actually obtain any results. This occurs for a wide variety of reasons. The most obvious is there's just no DNA in the sample. And why won't there be any DNA in the sample? Well, maybe because what you're analyzing isn't actually flesh of any animal or any plant. You might be looking at something entirely different. Or it is flesh, but it's so old and just the sample is so bad that there's no DNA left. All the DNA is degraded. It's past the point of genetic examination. Either one of those things could be true. However, earlier in the pamphlet, they said that they confirmed that the blood on the Eucharist was of the blood type AB. What's wrong with that?
You need a
if you didn't do the genetic profiling, how are you able to confirm that it was blood type AB? Genetic profiling is done, like, here's just a little silly Punnett square. Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm not on the right slide. Here we go. This is the slide that I'm talking about. So here's Tixla, and here's the I'm so sorry, I didn't advance the slide on this end. Look at that Punnett square on the bottom. The Punnett square shows that, like, you kind of have to get some genetic information if you want to determine what the blood type is. But the pamphlet itself says that they never obtained any kind of genetic profiling. So it's like, well, which one is it? The quality of the science here is not very good. And then the last Eucharistic miracle that I'm going to talk about is the miracle at Sokolka in Poland. This one is kind of hilarious because the team that was looking into this one reached out to two professors from a medical university in Poland. One of those two doctors was actually, and her name was Dr. Siboniak Lautowska. She was hired by the Vatican previously to work in part of the beatification process of Blessed Father Michael Sapoko. So that's the canonization process. So this one professor had been hired by the Vatican before, and they hired her again to look at this stuff. So they knew that she was friendly. What's really interesting about this one is, so take a look at that monstrance on the right. And all that there really is like a tiny little piece of host and then a big red blotch. Does that look kind of weird to you? Does it look a little bit like mold to you? I mean, I think it kind of looks like mold. And what's funny is that the pamphlet that they published about this one says that some people think that this is mold, but that's preposterous because Dr. Siboniak Lautowska said that it's not. And like, okay, fair enough. Dr. Siboniak Lautowska looked at it and thinks that it's human flesh, not mold. Well, guess what? After the Vatican published their statement saying, hey, look, guys, we approve this miracle. We think, and actually it wasn't the Vatican, it was like the Archdiocese. The Archdiocese in Poland said, like, yeah, this is legit, guys. We looked into this. All of a sudden, the medical university was figuring out about this for the first time. And they published a statement saying, Dr. Siboniak Lautowska and the other scientists who worked on this did not ask for university approval before they used university equipment to analyze these samples. They never ran this past anybody else at the university. We had nothing to do with this. Please do not let this reflect on the university, the fact that these two scientists used their personal time and personal judgment to make a call on this Eucharistic miracle. So, you know, take that for what it's worth.
This may sound really stupid because I haven't looked into this one at all, but like my first reaction is, okay, so the bread, according to Roman Catholics, the bread is the body tissue. And they're saying this, like, I would think, if anything, this is blood, not human tissue, if what they're saying is true. So wouldn't that contradict? Like, this is saying that the bread actually equates to Jesus' blood, not human tissue, right?
The official Catholic doctrine is that both are both. both the body, or sorry, both the bread and the wine both turn into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. Okay. So actually, in my tradition, in traditional Catholicism, we don't receive the blood. We only receive the body. So when we go up for communion, like in Novus Ordo Catholicism, you go up and you receive the Eucharist and you take a sip of the wine. In my tradition, nobody receives a sip of the wine except for the priest. We only receive the Eucharist, but it doesn't matter because both are both. So,
okay. Okay. All right. They haven't, they got me. All right.
Yeah. So the story on, oh, and by the way, this one occurred in 2008. So I picked one that occurred supposedly in the 8th century. Didn't hear about it until the 16th and was tested in the 1970s. Then I jumped ahead in time to 1992, 94, and 96 for Buenos Aires, 2006 for Tixla, and 2008 for Sokolka. Those were the ones that I chose to look at. And I find all of them to be really lacking, especially if you were going into this anticipating the rigor of the Shroud of Turin. It's just not there. Any questions about Eucharistic miracles before maybe we talk about some Marian apparition stuff and maybe some apostolic succession?
I think at this point let's finish off the Marian apparitions, and then I'm going to have two questions for you, and hopefully if anyone in the audience has questions, I'll raise it there, and then we'll go to apostolic succession.
Perfect. Okay. Perfect. I've got a couple slides on Marian apparitions, and I'm going to try to go through this a little quick. I picked out three apparitions. The first is Our Lady of Mount Carmel. There's a legend that says that in 1251, Our Lady appeared to St. Simon Stock and handed him a scapular. What is a scapular? It's a piece of cloth. You can actually see in the image on the right-hand side of the slide, Our Lady is holding a long piece of brown cloth that has like a hole in the middle. So that's where you put your head, and then the scapular hangs down in front and in back. That's what the scapular is. And she told St. Simon Stock that this scapular will be his habit. And a habit is what a monk wears. It's like a monk's uniform. So this will be your uniform. And anyone that dies wearing this uniform shall not suffer eternal fire. Those were the words of Our Lady, according to the legend. What about purgatory, though? Our Lady didn't say that you won't go to purgatory for a heck of a long time. And keep in mind, Catholics, right? So purgatory is part of the Catholic tradition. Well, enter the Sabbatine privilege. In a bull promulgated by Pope John XXII, the Pope said that Our Lady appeared to him too, and laid out some additional terms and conditions for how wearing the scapular can even get you out of purgatory early. See the next slide for the terms and conditions. And so I made a little diagram of the terms and conditions. So let's say that you've died of dysentery. Did you die wearing the scapular? If the answer is no, then you're just on your own. There's no promises for you. These promises only apply to people wearing the scapular. Okay, so then the answer is yes, you did die wearing the scapular. Great. Did you fulfill the terms and conditions as laid out in the papal bull promulgated by Pope John XXII? Those terms and conditions are as follows. The wearer must have been wearing the scapular continuously throughout your life. You can't just throw it on right as you're dying and they'd be like, oh, you know, great. You can do that, but then you don't fulfill the terms and conditions. Also, you must have observed chastity according to your station in life, and you must have received any one of the following options. You had to either recite daily the little office of the Blessed Virgin Mary, or you could observe the fasts of the church and abstain from meat on every Wednesday and Saturday, or you could say at least 5 decades of the rosary every day, or you could substitute some other good work. However, permission from a priest is required if the wearer is going to decide to pursue that option, to substitute for another good work. So if you fulfill those terms and conditions, great. The worst thing that's going to happen to you is that you're going to go to purgatory until the first Saturday after you die. Then on that first Saturday, Our Lady will personally descend into purgatory and yank you out of purgatory and bring you up to heaven. If, though, you do not fulfill those terms and conditions, then you still won't go to hell, because as long as you die wearing it, even if you put it on at the last second and you were never particularly holy in your life, you're not going to go to hell. But you might go to purgatory for a really long time. So those are the terms and conditions laid out in the papal bull promulgated by Pope John Paul XXII I'm sorry, not just Pope John the 22nd, not John Wall. Sacratissimo uti culmine. Okay.
Kevin, we do have a quick question that actually in here very quickly. Mr. Jetty says, so does this mean that Jesus went to purgatory because he didn't wear this scapula?
No. So Jesus did, though, descend into hell. And I don't fully remember why he descended into hell during the 3 days after his death. Mm-hmm. But he was definitely in hell doing something. I don't remember what he was doing. Oh, was it because the bosom of Abraham was actually like part of hell and he was like talking to Adam and Eve or something? I don't know. There's like some Catholic traditions about that stuff.
Gotcha. Yeah. He was freeing the good souls to go to heaven with him, I think.
That's right. The
beginning of hell, yeah.
Yeah. But no, there's no tradition about Jesus going to purgatory. Purgatory, according to Catholic tradition, is in order to make you ready for heaven. It's not supposed to be retribution. It's supposed to be like restoration. So the whole idea is you died and you weren't so evil that you're going to go to hell. However, you're not so good that you're going to go to heaven. So you kind of need to suffer for a little bit in purgatory until you're ready to go to heaven. That's kind of the general idea. Gotcha. But this exact point to me raises a problem. I'm sure I don't need, so everything that I just laid out here is crazy, right? Like all these, this sounds probably crazy to a Protestant audience. But just one thing that I'm going to highlight in. So is purgatory punitive then? If purgatory is restorative, not punitive, like it's supposed to be, then Mary personally descending into purgatory and yanking you out of there before you're ready sounds like a bad thing, not a good thing, right? Like, I don't understand the theology behind getting yanked out of purgatory early before you're ready. Like, that seems pretty problematic. Additionally, this whole thing is made up. So I literally can't find a single modern historian who actually thinks that the legend of Our Lady appearing to St. Simon Stock in 1251 or Our Lady appearing to Pope John the 22nd are real. No, not a single historian. Both of those events are considered ahistorical. Both originated in the 17th century, some 300 years after the events were supposed to happen. An Origin of the Brown Scapular, a criticism, was published in the year 1904. And since then, everybody understands that this is based on forgeries, actually. There were forgeries by a Carmelite priest in the 17th century where he kind of created a whole bunch of documents. And the whole thing is made up, including the papal bull. If you go onto the Catholic Encyclopedia and you look up that papal bull by Pope John the 22nd, the Catholic Encyclopedia is like, yeah, this thing's a forgery. Like, we know it's not real.
So. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, cool.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No. I was just, is this it for the Marian apparition? Okay. Good.
Do you want to talk about the Tilma?
I absolutely do, because that was going to be one of my questions. So, yeah.
Okay. Real quick, I have historicity concerns with the whole story. So, according to the legend, St. Juan Diego lived in... So the apparition appeared to him in like 1531, and then the Tilma got the miraculous image on it in 1531. A couple problems with that. The first sources of this legend come from 1648, over 100 years later. And then in 1649, we get more, but even the 1649 source comes from a native Mexican Indian. And it's called The Great Event, and it's like described as a poem kind of. So it seems fairly like legendary even then. And contemporaries of St. Juan Diego, such as Francisco de Bustamante, were publicly condemning the cult of Our Lady of Tepeyac, as she was called at the time. And Francisco de Bustamante wrote that these people were venerating an image painted yesterday by an Indian. So the historicity of the Tilma is like not great. And just very briefly on the actual Tilma. So we've looked at the Tilma with special like x-rays where we can actually see that the Tilma has been repainted a few times. We think that it was essentially repainted a few times, all in like a 20-year period or something like that. But under one of the under the current layer, we actually are pretty sure that we see initials on the bottom left-hand corner of the Tilma. And those initials are MC, which stands for Marcos Cipac, aka Marcos Cipac de Aquino, the famous 16th century Mexican native painter, who also painted other images that look very similar to what we see on the Tilma. So I don't think that there's anything supernatural about the Tilma. I actually don't even think it's a Tilma because it's not made out of Tilma material. It's made out of canvas. So yeah, the Tilma to me is just not at all. I'm not impressed by the Tilma.
Okay, cool. Out of curiosity, just very quickly on this. Well, we still got 20 minutes. So I'm interested because one of the supernatural claims here is, again, you, as you mentioned, that, look, this isn't a painted image. There's no directionality and that sort of thing. Now, how do you see this comparing to the Shroud of Turin, which also makes has an image on a linen cloth and that, and it does claim to say that, look, these images, there's no directionality here, and the images weren't painted and that sort of thing. But in terms of the non-directionality, do you see the Shroud's evidence as being superior in some way or compared to this? Or
yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, admittedly, part of that might be due to the vividness discrepancy between the two. If you actually just looked at the Shroud of Turin, like at an unaltered image of it, you might actually miss the fact that there's an image at all, right? The image is very faint, and it's not until you look at like a negative or like an altered image of the Shroud that the image really pops out. Like, you'll see it if you know what to look for on an unedited image, but it doesn't, like, you know, pop out of you. This does. I mean, this is an actual image of the Tilma of Guadalupe. Like, it's very vivid, and people who have studied the Tilma have actually said, like, oh no, yeah, there's brush strokes on it. Like, you can see the brush strokes on it. Like, they said, particularly look around the eyes and like, you'll see them.
Yeah. So that's one thing that I noticed kind of thing. Right. Whereas with the Shroud, we do have absolute proof about the directionless nature. I can, if you don't mind, I'll just quickly show so this was discovered in 1976, by scientist Don Lamont. Don Lin, who actually had worked on projects for NASA, but this is the proof of the directionless nature of the images. So I don't think the Tilma Mary portrait here has anything like this kind of proof and stuff. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that very quickly, but over to you.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And as far as I'm aware, a lot of the stuff about the Tilma appears just to be urban legend. Like, there are some pretty crazy urban legends about the Tilma, such as if you put a stethoscope up to, like, the belly of Our Lady, you hear a heartbeat because she's pregnant with the baby Jesus. It's just not true. but there's a story about that. There's this whole thing about if you zoom in on her eyes, you actually see reflections of everybody who was present in the room when Juan Diego presented the Tilma to the Bishop Zumarraga. But it's just ink blots. Like, if you look, it's 100% just a case of people seeing faces in ink blots. Like, it's
yeah that's something, and that happens even in Shroud circles at times, right? That's why you really gotta go by the peer review literature, make sure, you know, because there is a lot of, for example, people claim they can see the teeth with the Shroud. I can see them, but I think it's pareidolia. I don't think the teeth are actually there, kind of thing. So you got to be careful when you're judging things like that, I think. So that's it for your presentation on that. I have two follow-up questions before. Okay, never mind. Go ahead.
I'll do Fatima super quick. Fatima occurred in 1917 as two main components, the Miracle of the Sun and then the Prophecies. I'll start with the Miracle of the Sun. So according to the story, the sun dove down, it circled and then it dove down and it dried everybody off and then it went back up and everything was fine. Let's start with the obvious. The sun obviously did not really move in space. this would be undeniable across the globe, yet only people in Portugal saw it. And in fact, it was a 600 square mile radius. Those are the people who saw it. So right off the bat, the best case scenario for this would be a local event, like some kind of local atmospheric event, or a mass hallucination that just affected people within a 600 square mile radius. Both of those sound pretty crazy, and so I don't see why neither of those could be miraculous. But the way that a lot of Catholics talk about this is like the sun really did move, and it's like, well, clearly that's not the case. So best case scenario, this might be a miraculous local event or a miraculous mass hallucination, but it can't be the sun miraculously actually diving towards the earth. That absolutely did not happen. That being said, whatever did happen is still impressive. We do have eyewitnesses who claim that everyone around them, meaning everybody in the Cova de Iria, which is the Cova, the little area where the miracle occurred, saw something. We have multiple firsthand accounts of people saying, yeah, I saw it and everyone around me saw it. And they're describing it as the sun changing colors. They're describing it as the sun kind of zigzagging back and forth in the sky. Some of them describe it as the sun careening down towards the earth. And I find that super impressive and not something that we can just write off. Some people in neighboring towns claim that they saw it. However, I will add that a lot of those don't come from like the day of the event. It seems like some people were writing 30 years later and they're like, oh yeah, no, I saw it. Like I was in the other town and I saw it. So that does seem like a little weirder to me. And I should note that there were people present who were there and did not see anything. There's two in particular that I'm thinking of. There's one woman who was actually very distraught that she saw nothing. And she actually wrote a letter to her priest saying like, am I a sinner? Is that why I didn't see anything? And that's kind of interesting and something to note. And there was somebody else who was only a few miles away, well within that 600 square mile radius. It's just that their car was stuck in the mud on the side of the road because it was raining that day. And then when they got there, they're like, I can't believe I missed it. I missed everything. And it's like, well, did you miss it? Because like you were within the 600 square mile radius. Why did you not see anything? So it's not as spectacular as some Catholics would want you to believe, but it is spectacular enough that I can't write it off as like there's some easy solution. I think that if you ask me what happened, I think that there was some kind of like local event. I don't know what that event was, but whatever it was, I think that it was not so spectacular that it was impossible to miss if you weren't paying attention. But I do think that something in the atmosphere occurred on October 17th, 1917 in Portugal because enough people saw something that I think that something happened. Okay, that's the miracle of the sun. Yeah. And the three secrets, I'll make this super quick. The first secret is that Jacinta, so there was three kids who saw it. Lucia was the main one, and then her two cousins, Jacinta and Francisco. So the first secret was that they would die soon, but Lucia herself would live a while longer. The second secret was that World War I would end soon, but a new and worse war would break out during the reign of Pope Pius XI. And then the third secret was hidden for a long time and then released in 2000 and was supposedly fulfilled by the assassination attempt on Pope John Paul II, which occurred in 1980 or 1981 or something like that. Only problem, Francisca and Jacinta died in 1919 and 1920. Lucia didn't write about this this secret until 1927. There was no talk about it before. Secondly, World War I will end soon, but a new and worse war will break out during the reign of Pope Pius XI. Problem.
I didn't see Pius XI even there.
I know. I'm sorry. I left that out. I should have wrote Pius XI, but I didn't.
Okay.
Only problem. The fact that World War I would end soon was actually kind of part of the original of the original thing. In fact, there was a priest who interviewed Lucia the day after, or maybe a few days after October 17th. And Lucia was adamant that Our Lady told her that World War I would end that very day, October 17th. World War I did not end on October 17th, 1917. And the fact that she was adamant about it actually stressed out the priest who was interviewing her, because he asked her, he's like, I read the newspaper and there was a battle yesterday. So clearly Our Lady was wrong. And Lucia, who by the way is like young, she's like 13 or something at this time. She pretty much tells the priest, like, I don't know what to tell you. This is what Our Lady said. She said that the war would end that very day. Now the war did end a year later. And in 1941, in her journal, Sister Lucia wrote that Our Lady said that World War I would end soon instead of that very same day. So we do have a discrepancy there between what Lucia said when she was 13 and then when she said when she was like in her 40s or whatever. And what's interesting too is that in 1941, Lucia added that Our Lady also told her that a new and worse war would break out under the reign of Pope Pius XI. Now, what's interesting is that Pope Pius XI was indeed the Pope in 1939, when World War II started. However, he died in February of 1939. By September 1st, 1939, when Germany invaded Poland, Pope St. Pius XII was the reigning Pope. Now, modern historians say that World War II began on September 1st, 1939. But in 1941, it wasn't so clear that that was going to be the start date of World War II. Why? Because there were scrimmages going on prior to then. So I don't think it's entirely fair to say like, oh, look, like Lucia got it wrong. She got the wrong Pope. There were skirmishes going on prior to Germany's invasion of Poland. But the fact remains that she didn't write that down until 1941, 2 years after the start of World War II. So again, significantly less impressive when you actually look at the timeline. The third secret was actually hidden for a long time. There's this whole big discrepancy or debate about it where the Vatican released the full secret in the year 2000. A lot of people think that the Vatican is still hiding something. The Vatican and Sister Lucia both said, no, this is the whole thing. But a lot of people also think that Sister Lucia died a long time ago and was replaced by an imposter. There's this whole thing. It's really complicated. But the third secret is the only secret that was shared before the events came true. So also in 1941, Lucia wrote about how the Pope will go on a pilgrimage up a mountain through a ruined city. The Pope will be joined by tons of bishops and priests and even lay people. And when they get to the top of the mountain, there's going to be three big crosses at the top of the mountain. And then soldiers with guns and bows and arrows are going to mow down the Pope and all of the people there. And there's going to be tons of martyrs. Boom, end scene. That's the prophecy. When the Vatican released this prophecy in the year 2000, the Vatican said, hey, this prophecy was fulfilled by the assassination attempt on Pope St. John Paul II, which that assassination attempt took place in 1980 or 1981, something like that. And so the Vatican released a 1941 message in the year 2000 that the Vatican says was fulfilled in 1980. But it's so vague. And notably, there's some like real discrepancies. Like the Pope dies in the vision and the Pope did not die in real life. Pope John Paul II survived the assassination attempt in 1980. Also, nobody else died. And in the vision, like tons of people died, like not just the Pope, but bishops and priests and lay people. So there's a lot of like discrepancies. And I do just kind of get a kick out of the fact that the first and second prophecy were very specific. And both occurred after those prophecies had already come true. And the third one was not at all specific and was the only one that came out before it came true. Kind of convenient. That's the end of my section on Marian apparitions. Dale, I'd love to take questions or questions from the audience.
Yeah, sure. So if anyone has questions in the audience, go ahead and put that in the chat. But yeah, we do have one of your fans, New Gloff, is here. Just saying.
What's up, Gloff?
Thanks for the content, and he came over from your channel. But yeah, okay. So again, press for time. So I'll just ask one question, I guess, and then how do you want to do the section on apostolic succession before you got to go, or do you
I'm happy to, and I can push it a little bit too. The peak occurs like. I can give you another 20 minutes, 15 minutes for sure.
Okay, cool. So yeah, I'll just ask, one thing that you didn't cover in your presentation that I'm very interested in, I think you did a great video on, is this issue of lords. Because as you'll know, you interviewed our mutual friend, Caleb Jackson, and he points to these, what does he call them? The Lambertini criteria for identifying. So just briefly, what's your kind of take on the Lord's miracles? Do you think that there's any potential proof for a miracle on that front, or do you find that unpersuasive?
Yeah, so the Lords thing, there's two different aspects to the Lords thing. So there's the Lords Medical Bureau, and then there's the Vatican-approved miracles. There are over like 100 times more Lords Medical Bureau-approved miracles than there are Vatican-approved miracles. Like, there's thousands of miracles approved by the Lords Medical Bureau, the vast majority of which occurred in the 1910s and 20s and 30s and stuff like that. And even like the late 1800s. Meanwhile, the Vatican stuff has kind of trickled in slowly over time. The Vatican stuff is much higher quality. There's fewer of them, right? There's fewer of them. In fact, 70, I think, right? Yes, 70. The most recent of which was 2018 or something. So the Vatican approved ones are of much higher quality. So I'm not very impressed by the Lord's Medical Bureau. I'm much more impressed by the Vatican stuff. I haven't looked into all of the Vatican stuff super deeply, but there are some people who have. So for instance, James Randi, the famous skeptic, for lack of a better term, and magician, he actually hired a team of doctors to look into some of these cases approved by the Vatican. And that team of doctors had some serious questions about how the Lord's Medical, how the Vatican was able to approve some of these miracles. They said that, like, for some of them, for instance, like, there was one where they said that a man was cured of paralysis, and they said, like, the correct tests were never performed on this man to see whether or not his paralysis was actually, like a mental paralysis or like a nerve damage paralysis. And obviously people can recover from a mental paralysis, but you really can't recover from a nerve damage paralysis. So I'm still skeptical, but obviously without having, like, you know, I haven't looked into all 70 of them as deeply as James Randi looked into that one. So I'm kind of in a state of agnosticism about a lot of them. I will tell you that I do think that there are cases, like legitimate cases of cures that happen that are spontaneous, and we have no idea how they happen. And I part of that, I think, is just because we don't know as much as we wish that we did, you know, particularly when it comes to biology. So I'm totally happy to admit that some spontaneous, crazy cures have happened throughout human history, and we have no good explanation for them. Totally happy to admit that. I'm just not positive that Lords is causing these, if that makes sense.
Okay. All right. So one question composed of two parts. So in the first place, this will be easy. From Mr. Jetty, he asks, have you personally seen anything that you would define as a miracle? And my second question to that, okay, go ahead. Do you have a, yeah, go ahead and answer that one.
So me, no. But I have held cool Catholic relics. Like, I've held a piece of the True Cross. Obviously, it's not a piece of the True Cross, but we all thought it was. yeah. So no, but I have held cool relics.
Awesome. Okay. So my last question, then we're going to move on to that apostolic succession, I promise. But okay. So I'm wondering if we could, let's say we can convince you and even me that there is something miraculous or supernatural in nature going on with one or more of these examples. Let's say we do get convinced of that. Do you think that these do actually provide proof for Catholicism specifically? Or, because this is my biggest debate with Caleb Jackson. I don't think it proves Catholicism, even if I grant it. So what would be your take? If these are supernatural, does it prove Catholicism or, yeah?
It's probably going to depend on the Marian apparition, because, like, I think Fatima, if proven true, would point really strongly to Catholicism, thanks to its, like, the rosary played a key part in the Marian apparition of Fatima. Lourdes, though, it's the big, like, if all that we did with Lourdes is prove that these miraculous healings really did occur, I mean, God could just be healing faithful Christians. You know what I mean? So Lourdes, probably less evidence on the Catholic specific side, but I would have a really hard time imagining Fatima being true and Catholicism being false. I would have a hard time reconciling that, probably.
Gotcha. All right, cool. So, yeah, I will turn it over to, because we also have our second portion of the show on apostolic succession. And I want to, this is something I've been struggling with. I would imagine the arguments are going to be the same, mostly the same for Orthodox and Roman Catholic. So I wanted to see your take on this as a unbeliever.
Yeah. So apostolic succession is like a big, it's a big deal in the Catholic Church, right? So the Catechism of the Catholic Church, entry 811, says that, so this is the sole Church of Christ in which the creed we profess to be one holy Catholic and apostolic. These four characteristics, inseparably linked with one another, indicate essential features of the Church and her mission. The Church does not possess them of herself. It is Christ who, through the Holy Spirit, makes his Church one holy Catholic and apostolic. What does it mean to be apostolic? It means that all bishops are part of a lineage that goes back to the time of the apostles, something that is, quote, impossible in Protestant denominations, most of which do not even claim to have bishops. So it's a big deal to Catholics, the apostolicity of the Catholic Church. And the idea is that Catholic bishops have a direct lineage all the way back to the apostles. So it would look something like this. You know, you have Jesus who appoints the 12. The 12 appoint, you know, people who appoint people who appoint people who appoint people. And then, by the way, like Pope Francis has a direct lineage straight back to Jesus through the original 12. That's the general idea. And this is very important. And a Protestant can't, like a Protestant minister was never laid hands on by somebody who was appointed by somebody who was appointed by somebody who was appointed by somebody. And that is one of the marks of the true church. And so that's kind of the Catholic, and I'm simplifying here, but that's kind of the Catholic idea. It's like that, hey, look, it's really important that you can actually draw that lineage all the way back to Jesus through the 12. Protestant ministers, by and large, can't do that. Catholics can. And so can the Orthodox, by the way. And that's why you see the Orthodox included in that bottom row right there. I'm leaving the Orthodox out of this conversation for simplicity's sake. But that's the idea. That's why it's important. However, I'm going to challenge that using biblical data. We know who the 12 were, right? Peter, Andrew, James, and John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Tom, Simon, Thaddeus, James, and Judas. These are the 12 that Christ gave to us. But when Judas fell from grace, Matthias was chosen to take his place. Those are the 12. And then minus one plus one. And so if you don't have a direct line to Jesus through those 12, you're not the real deal, according to the Catholic Church. However, take a look at this chart of apostolic succession. This is a really cool chart because it shows you the first several generations worth of bishops, who they were appointed by, and their direct line back to Jesus. So you can see here that from Jesus, we have the 12, and then it says Judas was replaced by Matthias down here. And then, hey, look, these people were appointed by, and it tries to draw like a line like this. I would like to take a look at Linus. So I want to look right here first in particular. And if this is a little bit small, I will be saying this out loud. But even in here, let's zoom in right there. Okay. So, oh, perfect. Thank you. So if we take a look at the number one that's circled right, it's like the circle within the circle in the upper right-hand corner. That says, it says Linus, and it's spelt like the Latin way, but that's Linus. And so he was actually the Pope. Depending on how you count it, he was even like the first Pope. But a lot of people say that Peter was the first Pope. So then Linus was the second Pope. If you read some of the church fathers, they actually just started counting popes after Peter. Like for whatever, like, you know, they just don't call Peter a Pope. It's just like kind of like, hey, the first Pope is the first successor of Peter in Rome, kind of. So depending on how you want to count it, Linus was the first or the second Pope. And again, Pope just meaning Bishop of Rome. And if you take a look according to this, it kind of looks like, so it says St. Peter's and Paul founded the church in Rome, commissioning their episcopate in Linus. And then Linus right there is kind of like the number one person up there, it looks like. There's a little bit of a problem with that. I want to draw your attention to who is not included among the 12. Paul, right? Paul was not one of the 12. That isn't, that's not controversial, right? That Paul was not one of the 12. Peter was, of course, but Paul was not. Well, guess what? St. Linus wasn't appointed by St. Peter. He was appointed by Paul. Of the church in Rome, Linus, the son of Claudia, was the first. Again, they're not saying that Peter wasn't pope. They're just saying that, like, Linus was the first successor of Peter. Ordained by Paul. I'm sorry. Paul is ordaining people? Paul's not one of the 12. How do they have their line to Jesus if not through Paul? Take a look over here again. It's, according to Paul, because he was appointed by Jesus to, you know, I guess, carry out Jesus's work directly by Jesus himself. And I don't understand how that's any different than what the Protestants are claiming, right? Like, you know, the Protestant pastor who runs, you know, Jim Bob's church of the first Reformed Episcopate, of the second Reformed cousin of the church of the first Baptists in New Hampshire or whatever, like that church, I don't understand why that Protestant pastor couldn't say, like, no, like, just like Paul, I was appointed directly by Jesus. Like, I don't know if I understand the argument that it's super important to have a line through the 12. Paul himself didn't have a line through the 12. Linus didn't have a line through the 12. And Gloff, Paul absolutely did meet Peter. However, Paul started appointing people and he started preaching prior to his meeting Peter. Paul didn't get told by Jesus, like, you know, hey, you know, you're my guy, Paul. And then he didn't go seek out one of the 12. He just kind of started doing his thing. So I don't think that there's this argument where, like, Paul was obviously subject to Peter. I mean, in fact, we see Peter and Paul arguing in the New Testament, right? Like, they didn't really get along. And so for that reason, I don't really understand the importance of going through the 12. It seems like the very first pope, second if you count Peter, the first replacement of Peter anyway, didn't have a line through St. Peter. The first pope after Peter was appointed by St. Paul. And if that's good enough for the first pope after St. Peter, I don't understand why that can't be good enough for modern Protestant pastors.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah, you already responded to Neugloff. I was going to raise his potential objection there, but you responded to that already. So yeah, I guess one question I had is when I was looking into this, I was looking into potential proofs that people would have, right? So, you know, they'll point to certain New Testament texts, like in Timothy saying, like, oh, well, you know, you laying on of hands, you know, Paul, I taught you, Timothy, you taught these next generation, that generation, they'll teach the next and stuff like that. And they'll also appeal to like the early church fathers and stuff like. So I'm kind of curious about your take about these proof texts, particularly from people like Ignatius or Polycarp and those New Testament texts in Timothy. Do you think that these are a good basis to believe in the doctrine of apostolic succession in general or not?
I mean, I think that like best case scenario, it would be the doctrine of apostolic and Pauline succession, you know? Like I think that that's going to have to be the best case scenario because it seems like even the Roman church is cool with people being appointed by Paul. And Paul was appointed directly by Jesus. So maybe you want to argue that Paul is a special case and like we shouldn't, like there will never be another Paul. And like if you want to make that argument, very well, make the argument, go ahead. And that's not really for me to probably weigh in on. Like if somebody wanted to make the argument that like there will never be another Paul and like, you know, we can't, I would kind of say like, well, okay, I'm not Christian. I'm an agnostic. So I'll let you guys duke that out among yourselves. But unless you want to make the argument that Paul was a one-off case, which, you know, might be a little weird. Like, I don't know why Paul would be a one-off case, I guess. Then it seems like having your direct line to Jesus is going to be good enough, right? Because Paul didn't have his direct line to his direct. Paul's direct line to Jesus did not go through the 12. Linus's direct line to Jesus did not go through the 12. And Linus was the first pope after Peter. So I guess I just don't see the importance of having a direct line to Jesus through the 12. I don't see why your direct line to Jesus can't go through Paul or the maximalist case. I don't see why your direct line can't be straight to Jesus, kind of like Paul's direct line straight to Jesus. So,
yeah, looks like Mr. Jetty and Neugloff are kind of agreeing there and saying, yeah, you know, Jesus was a priest by the order of Melchizedek and So Jenny's saying, yeah, you know, Paul was appointed by Jesus just like the 12. So for them, that would presumably would be just as good. So yeah, I guess I'll just ask, when do you think in church history this the notion of apostolic succession, as the Roman Catholics teach it, when do you think that came in?
I mean, like very, very early, right? Because like, you know, it seems like even apostolic fathers are talking about it, right? Like prior to the end of like the third century, right? Like when was, so.
I think the first that I've seen that could teach anything like it is Irenaeus around 180. Before that, I just don't see it, but that's me as a Protestant and stuff. So I wanted to get your take.
Yeah. So when I said very, very early, I essentially meant like, you know, I consider the second century to be very early. And it's, you know, everything is relative, right? I think that that's early. It's obviously not from the time of the apostles themselves, but it's not like the medieval church made this up whole cloth, right? You know, I think it's very early, just probably not biblical era. You know, it's 100 years after the last gospel was written or whatever, you know, maybe not 100 years, but it's a few generations after the time of the apostles did apostolic succession become important. That's the way it seems to me. And Glof, to answer your question, why couldn't it have been, where you said, why can't it be Peter to Paul to Linus through the 12? That would be through the 12 if that is what happened. And like, it could have, like it's not impossible. That's how things could have occurred. It's just that that's not how things did occur. Peter didn't appoint Paul. Like Paul didn't seek out Peter being like, hey, I would really like to become a bishop. Can you appoint me? Peter met Paul and he was already, no, I'm the same as you, man. Like Jesus appeared to me too. Paul kind of doesn't seem super weirded out by the fact that Jesus's appearance to Paul was like more spiritual and Peter's was more physical. Paul doesn't seem like he's really is super concerned about that. Paul seems like he's like, no, I've got my direct line to Jesus, man. I'm good. Like you and I are going to fight about things. And clearly they did fight about things. It could have been Peter, Paul, Linus. It's just that it wasn't.
Makes sense. Awesome. All right, cool. Well, yeah, from what I can tell, that does it for the questions in the audience and stuff like that. And obviously I know we've got the eclipse to get to. So like,
yes,
I'm good at leaving it here, but I had a great time. I wish we had more time because you were very knowledgeable. I mean, on this stuff, you presented very sound arguments and everything like that. So I would love to have you back on again sometime and discussing this or other topics.
I need to have you back on to finish our first conversation. So I'll come back on yours to finish this conversation too. We'll just double up on both ends.
There we go. Awesome. All right, cool. Thank you so much for being here, guys. I hope the audience enjoyed the show and don't burn your eyes out looking at the eclipse today.
Yes. Be safe, everybody.
There you go. Have a great week. So just so you guys know in the audience, so my next show will be on Friday, April 12th. And it will be Shroud of Turin, the ultimate showdown between pro shroud experts and shroud skeptics on the carbon dating. Tune into that around 11 a.m. on Friday, April 12th. All right, take care.